Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Today's press conference by President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin in Helsinki is being described as shocking, astonishing, even treasonous. The two leaders talked about Syria, North Korea, and the 2016 U.S. election, and FBI Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation of possible Trump campaign collusion with Russians. A few days ago, the Justice Department indicted 12 Russians, many of them military officers, for election interference. Trump was asked about a tweet this morning in which he blamed U.S. foolishness and stupidity and the Russia investigation for bad U.S.-Russia relations.
I think that the United States has been foolish. I think we've all been foolish. We should have had this dialogue a long time ago, a long time, frankly, before I got to office. And I think we're all to blame. I think that the United States now has stepped forward along with Russia, and we're getting together, and we have a chance to do some great things, whether it's nuclear proliferation in terms of stopping. We have to do it. Ultimately, that's probably the most important thing that we can be working on. But I do feel that we have both made some mistakes. I think that the probe is a disaster for our country. I think it's kept us apart. It's kept us separated. There was no collusion at all. Everybody knows it. People are being brought out to the fore. So far that I know, virtually none of it related to the campaign. And they're going to have to try really hard to find somebody that did relate to the campaign. That was a clean campaign. I beat Hillary Clinton easily, and frankly, we beat her. And I'm not even saying from the standpoint, we won that race. And it's a shame that there can even be a little bit of a cloud over it.
President Putin responded through a translator.
As to who is to be believed, as to who is not to be believed, you can trust no one if you take this. Where did you get this idea that President Trump trusts me or I trust him? He defends the interests of the United States of America, and I do defend the interests of the Russian Federation. We do have interests that are common. We are looking for points of contact. There are issues where our postures diverge, and we are looking for ways to reconcile our differences, how to make our effort more meaningful. We should not proceed from the immediate political interests that guide certain political powers in our countries. We should be guided by facts. Could you name a single fact that would definitively prove the collusion? This is utter nonsense.
President Trump was asked whether on the world stage in front of Putin he would denounce Putin and the Russian cyber threat, which as recently as last Friday, Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats likened to warning lights that are blinking red again. Instead, Trump blasted the FBI during the Obama administration for dragging its feet in the investigation of Hillary Clinton's private email server.
So let me just say that we have two thoughts. You have groups that are wondering why the FBI never took the server. Why haven't they taken the server? Why was the FBI told to leave the office of the Democratic National Committee? I've been wondering that. I've been asking that for months and months, and I've been tweeting it out and calling it out on social media. Where is the server? I want to know, where is the server, and what is the server saying? With that being said, all I can do is ask the question. My people came to me, Dan Coats came to me, and some others. They said they think it's Russia. I have President Putin. He just said it's not Russia. I will say this. I don't see any reason why it would be, but I really do want to see the server.
President Putin offered to have Russian officials investigate the 12 Russians indicted last week for hacking Democratic Party institutions and the Clinton campaign, saying he knew how dossiers are made. An interesting word choice, given that FBI officials have been investigating a so-called dossier that Russians may have of Trump cavorting with prostitutes during the Miss Universe pageant in Moscow in 2013.
I'd like to add something to this. After all, I was an intelligence officer myself. And I do know how dossiers are made up. Just a second. That's the first
thing. Putin was asked if he had any compromising material on Trump or his family.
Yeah, I did hear these rumors that we allegedly collected compromising material on Mr. Trump when he was visiting Moscow. Well, distinguished colleague, let me tell you this. When President Trump visited Moscow back then, I didn't even know that he was in Moscow. I treat President Trump with utmost respect. But back then, when he was a private individual, a businessman, nobody informed me that he was in Moscow.
Some of the sound from today's press conference in Helsinki.
Well, let's bring in Will Pomerantz now. He's a Russia expert and deputy director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center. Will, start with this united front of Putin and Trump against the Trump Justice Department Russia investigation. Former CIA Director John Brennan tweeted out, Trump's press conference reached the level of high crimes and misdemeanors, meaning it's impeachable. It was nothing short of treasonous. Your thoughts?
Well, I don't know if it rises to the level of treason. What's interesting is that both President Trump and President Putin were in agreement that essentially what has happened in the Justice Department is not based on the evidence. And they both claim at the press conference and in other communications that it is a witch hunt. So you have this very awkward circumstance, I think, that is really unprecedented, where the President of the United States and the President of Russia are in agreement that the U.S. Justice Department and the U.S. FBI is conducting a false and unfair investigation. So I think this is really uncharted territory.
Right. We heard from former NATO Commander James Stavridis that any other American president would only have taken this meeting with President Putin to put him on the world stage and publicly accuse him of meddling with an election. Instead, Trump was asked pointedly if he believed the assessment of the U.S. intelligence community about Russian interference in the election. Now, we heard that President Putin had volunteered to do an investigation, but here's what President Trump said.
President Putin was extremely strong and powerful in his denial today. And what he did is an incredible offer. He offered to have the people working on the case come and work with their investigators with respect to the 12 people. I think that's an incredible offer.
By 12 people, he means the 12 people who've been indicted by Mueller's investigation. Look, this is President Putin, who has an abysmal record on human rights, state-controlled media. President Trump applauding the fact that he would investigate Russians accused of hacking the U.S. election.
Well, I don't think that is a good offer. And anyone familiar with the Russian criminal justice system would not agree that it is appropriate for to invite the Russian security services and the Russian law enforcement agencies to investigate their own. This has happened before. It was interesting that President Putin raised the question of Bill Browder. Bill Browder was associated with Sergei Magnitsky, who was tortured and then died in jail. And again, it involved an investigation, but the Russian state not only refused to fully investigate the charges, it turned the charges against Magnitsky and accused him of theft. So Russia does not have a good track record, to say the least, in terms of cooperation. And I thought it was very revealing that Putin demanded Browder if indeed we were to have access to the 12 Russians military security officers.
Look, it was said to be a big win for President Putin that he even got on this stage. Russia does have a nuclear arsenal. The two men talked about reducing their arsenals. But it's a dwindling economy, not even as big as California. So did he then go on to win overall because of the President Trump's united front with a Russian? I mean, as you've said, nobody can remember seeing an American president so publicly side with a Russian president against the American Justice Department.
This was clearly a win for Vladimir Putin, because you're right. While Russia still has a large and important nuclear arsenal, it does not have a first-rate world economy. It is not our competitor in that sense in the global marketplace. And yet there was President Trump giving President Putin equal billing on the global stage. So in many ways, what was interesting was the fact that President Trump wanted to give him this equal billing, and that he allowed the question period to really undermine everything that he thought he might be accomplishing right. at this summit.
Look, and this comes on the heels of the NATO summit. What's happened here? Has there been a global shift, or will it wrench itself back? Because this is also, in President Putin, a man who's been accused of being behind poisonings in the UK. He was behind Russia's annexation of Crimea from Ukraine in 2014. Continued support for pro-Russian rebels, the shooting down of a passenger plane by a Russian missile. And yet he was treated better today than U.S. allies were at the NATO meeting. Has everything changed?
This is an alarming development. And if it continues, then yes, we are witnessing a shift in global affairs. Putin, interestingly, said that he wanted to discuss global affairs from a non-ideological standpoint. And it seems that Trump agrees with that. But that means that the United States does not bring its values and its principles to the global stage. Mm. And I think if the United States acts simply like Russia as a global power that is only interested in sovereignty, then the whole world suffers, and also our allies.
Bill Pomerantz of the Wilson Center, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
On Monday, July 16th, 1945, at 5:29 in the morning, scientists tested the first atomic bomb. It was part of the secretive Manhattan Project, and within several weeks, the U.S. would use the bomb to destroy the cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, plunging the world into a nuclear arms race that continues to this day. Our next story is about what happened the night before the dawn of the nuclear age, near the blast site in New Mexico, where an extraordinary sound rose out of the desert. Jeff Rice has this reporter's notebook.
Felix DePaola was just 18 years old and a private in the Army when he witnessed the world's first atomic test at Trinity Base Camp in New Mexico.
We felt the shock wave and then the heat wave, you know.
Now in his 90s, DePaola is one of the few people still alive to have seen the blast firsthand.
It was fairly dark because of the cloud cover that day. There was cloud cover from the rain, but the whole canyon lit up.
The rain had almost delayed the test. It had cleared enough that morning for the scientists to go ahead, but the night before was marked by a summer monsoon that came down hard. As the scientists and engineers waited for the morning, they heard what seemed like 1,000 voices calling in the desert.
And boy, they were croaking like crazy. One of the GIs that I was with told me, he said, they're toads, Felix.
I first heard about the toads of Trinity from a 1973 archival interview with Frank Oppenheimer, the brother of Robert Oppenheimer, best known as the father of the atomic bomb. In the interview, Frank described what he called frogs at Trinity Base Camp.
The night before the test, all the frogs in that era had gathered in a little pond by the camp and copulated and squalled all night long. And there was a kind of funny significance to the only living thing around there coming together. I mean, everything was full of import.
It was a small detail compared to the events that were about to happen. But in the drama of the mostly sleepless night before the test, the toads resonated in the ears of the scientists waiting for the morning. They've since become a footnote to the atomic age, but little else has really been said or written about them. What did they sound like? Why were they there? Whatever happened to the toads of Trinity? So I decided to set out to see if I could find them. 2 years ago, in July, I was given special permission from the Army to come to a small patch of ground near the Trinity site in New Mexico, where I would be allowed to wait for darkness and listen.
Okay, ground zero is right up there.
Jim Eccles is a historian of the Trinity test and a retired public affairs officer for the range. On this day, he's my guide.
That's where the creosote, that dark green band along there, used to be uninterrupted until the atomic bomb explosion burned off all the creosote in a nice circle.
He takes me to an abandoned ranch on the White Sands Missile Range, where the Manhattan Project scientists and their support crew prepared for and watched the explosion.
This was the default position for watching, but there were several hundred people here.
Not much is here now, except for a couple of adobe buildings, a few fences, and a large water tower. But next to that, is a massive earthen basin that sometimes fills with rainwater and presumably toads.
And the missile range calls it Pond Site on their maps because of these catchment basins over here.
The term pond site seems like an exaggeration at best. Today it's 106 degrees in the shade, and the soil looks like it hasn't seen water in years. But scientists I spoke with were confident there were toads here then and now, burrowed under the ground, waiting. Doug Burkett is a biologist for the range.
They are underground and staying completely dormant, where they can survive long extended periods of drought, so they're very rarely on the surface.
He says the toads can stay underground for up to 7 years and come up for short periods of time here only when conditions are favorable, that is, following large rain events and during the July-August monsoon season. Burkett says there may have been as many as 5 different species of toads calling at base camp in 1945. I asked him if he thought the toads might still be here.
They were certainly here in the same ones that are there now. These guys have really been protected as far as the habitats on the missile range. Overall, the land has not changed much at all.
As the sun sets back at base camp, I'm left alone in the desert, just me and the ghosts of the Manhattan Project. The wind picks up, and I can feel the humidity rising. I crouch behind the door of my car and listen for hours. But that night, there is no rain, and there are no toads. A year later, at home in Seattle, I receive an email from my contact at the range. Conditions are more favorable. It's rained at base camp. I catch a plane to Albuquerque and drive more than 100 miles south to the missile range. It's August 1st, and the heat is still intense. But this time, when I get there, sure enough, there is water. The ditches around base camp are full of tadpoles. The toads are still there. I wait for darkness, and the sound starts faintly from the edge of camp. I see several species of toads that night. Some are basking in the chocolate-colored water in the ditches. Others are simply hopping through base camp. It rained a few days ago, and you can still hear the green toads call in the distance. By midnight, the toad's call has risen to a scream. I am immediately struck by this intense struggle for life. But on the other side of all this is the legacy of the atomic bomb. 200,000 dead at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, generations of fear, and the threat of world annihilation that we still face today. Physicist Robert Oppenheimer seemed to wrestle with this profound ambivalence as he tried to come to grips with what he and the other scientists had accomplished here in the desert.
We knew the world would not be the same. Few people laughed. Few people cried. Most people were silent.
In a 1965 NBC documentary about the bomb, Oppenheimer recalled the words from the Bhagavad Gita, a Hindu scripture that he would sometimes read in the original Sanskrit.
Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds.
Despite that dire vision, on this night at least, it feels like there is a new world being created all around me. For Here and Now, I'm Jeff Rice.
Jeff's story was produced with support from the Acoustic Atlas at Montana State University. The recorded interview with Frank Oppenheimer was provided by the Niels Bohr Library and Archives at the American Institute of Physics. So, the toads persevered. The black rhinos in Kenya may not, after an attempt at conservation went terribly wrong. 8 out of 11 seemingly healthy rhinos being transported from a national park to a sanctuary died. The Kenyan government called it an unprecedented death toll. They believe salty water was the cause. Vicky Croak covers all things animals for us. And Vicky, lately yours has been a very sad beat. But we understand that the transfer of the rhinos started at the end of last month as part of a long-planned effort to help them to safely establish a new breeding population. How could this have happened?
Oh, it's such a tragedy, Robin. Mm-hmm. You know, Kenyan officials had talked about the safety and environmental checks they had done before this translocation began. But so far, the government has not made clear when exactly the rhinos died or the exact circumstances. But veterinarians with the Kenyan Wildlife Service say it was salt poisoning, that apparently there was high salinity in the water of their new home, which can cause deadly dehydration. Mm. Now the program, which had been ready to move even more rhinos, has been suspended, and the government says it's bringing in experts for an independent inquiry.
So there's so much salt in the water, so they get thirsty, they drink more, and they get sicker. I mean, they're getting sicker and then sicker and sicker. What about the remaining three rhinos from the original group?
It appears they are okay, that they're alive. A government statement earlier said they were now, in fact, receiving fresh, safe water. But this is where conservation groups and advocates are pointing out the need for some fast transparency. Paula Kahumbu, the chief executive of Wildlife Direct, that's a conservation group in Kenya, mm-hmm. She said that a little boy had asked her what so many of us are wondering. How could this happen? Were the remote cameras focused on the animals? Were members of the relocation team or veterinarians with the rhinos? Couldn't they see that the rhinos were getting sick? And Kahumbu says she doesn't have answers to those questions because official information is so scant.
And we should say we do know that moving animals like this isn't easy. We've talked about this. The move in 2016 that involves some greater one-horned rhinos in Nepal. It's always risky. You're tranquilizing and moving huge wild animals, then you have to bring them back, but it's often done safely.
That's right. And I mean, right in Kenya alone, from 2005 to 2017, the government, by its own count, has moved 149 rhinos in this way in various conservation efforts. And the Ministry of Tourism says that only 8 have been lost in the process, scattered all of those years. And they're not talking about the 8 in this most recent incident this year. So to lose 8 at once now, 8 out of just 11, is really shocking.
Look, where are we worldwide with rhinos? We know about the death of the last male northern white rhino this past spring. But these deaths in Kenya, talk about rhino conservation in general.
It's tough. Globally, poachers have become more and more sophisticated in killing rhinos and collecting their horn for the illegal trade. Black rhinos, according to the World Wildlife Fund, their numbers were reduced by 98% in Africa between 1960 and 1995. Mm-hmm. But the last couple of decades, conservation efforts have helped the population climb back up, and it stands above 5,000. One thing for sure, Robin, we know individual animals matter, and all gains are fragile. Any loss is hard to take.
Right. And at 5,000, they're still endangered, black rhinos.
Yeah. That's right.
Vicky Croak covers all things animals for us. She's host of WBUR's The Wildlife blog. We highly recommend it. Vicky, thanks for commenting on the death of these 8 magnificent creatures. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Amazon Prime members around the world are gearing up for Prime Day. It launches today and ends tomorrow night at midnight. It's kind of a Black Friday for members, with more than 1 million deals on everything from smartphones to fitness trackers to kitchen appliances. Jill Schlesinger is business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Her podcast is Better Off. Hi, Jill.
Hello, and let me fully disclose, a Prime member.
I'm a Prime member, too. But do you think it's worth it, if you're not a Prime member, to buy a Prime membership for this sale tomorrow?
You know, I may be able to save you the $119 that the Prime membership costs now. You can sign up for a free 1 month trial that will allow you to take advantage of the day. Just don't forget to turn off the automatic renewal before the end of the trial if you don't want to get charged for the service going forward. Now, that said, if you want to get unlimited 2-day shipping and you want to catch some of Amazon's originals, Transparent or The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, which I loved, or you like downloading Audible books, maybe the $119 is worth it.
How worth it is it for Amazon? How big of a deal is Prime Day?
I mean, it's pretty huge. The company said last year's Prime Day grew by more than 60% compared to the previous one. And estimates were that the day brought in something like $2.4 billion. And this year, estimates are for another billion, $3.4 billion. Now, of course, that's partially because the event has increased to 36 from 30 hours. I also should note that a lot of people do actually join Prime. Last year, the company said new members joined Prime at the highest pace than any single day in Amazon history. I suspect we'll see similar results this year.
Doesn't this just make it so much harder, though, for small businesses to compete in this market with Amazon doing stuff like this and probably putting more of them out of business?
Absolutely. I read a stat that just blew my mind, even though I knew it intuitively. 49% of U.S. online sales, so almost half of every online sale in the United States, is done through Amazon. Hmm. I mean, if that's not big, I don't know what is. So absolutely, it does make it hard. Now, you know, Amazon will say, oh, no, no, the small businesses, they can sell through us. We have great partnerships. But yes, it's quite difficult.
Well, what is the bigger retail picture looking like now? I know that retail sales numbers were just released.
Yeah, well, retail sales were up in June by 0.5% from May. And it looks like spending really has picked up in the second quarter. We got off to a slow start at the beginning of the year. So retail sales are up 5.9% from the second quarter of last year. I should also note in that retail sales report, really interesting, yes, higher vehicle sales, yes, higher gas prices driving the headline figure. But I should also say department store sales fell by 1.8%, the heftiest decline in more than 2 years. Guess where we're spending more time, Jeremy?
Online.
At Amazon, I guess.
Should we expect productivity to drop in the next 24 hours or so?
I would have to offer the following caution. Of course, you need to be able to scroll away from that screen. But yeah, people are going to be knocking around and doing their thing. It's usually exactly 5 minutes, so I wouldn't go too crazy if you're the boss.
I'm wondering if the future of Thanksgiving Day is going to be not the Macy's parade, but maybe the Amazon parade. Who knows?
It hurts,
we'll
Jeremy.
See. It does hurt. What about those big balloons? Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Thank you.
Take care.
The University of Georgia released a study recently that showed an estimated 111 million metric tons of plastic garbage will pile up around the world by 2030. That's because most of the plastic we use is not recycled. Earlier this year, China effectively banned imports of 24 kinds of foreign waste, including plastics, and the U.S. is grappling with what to do with the plastics it used to send to China for recycling. Plastic that isn't recycled often ends up in landfills and in the ocean, where it injures and kills sea life and forms huge islands of garbage. So is there a better way to recycle plastic waste? Jamie Garcia thinks so. She's a polymer chemist at IBM. Jamie, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
And there are only some plastics that are recyclable. There are symbols on most plastic containers that tell you if it can be recycled or not. But can you first just walk us through how many different kinds of plastics are there in the world?
Oh, there's many. So the ones that have numbers on the bottom of them, there's numbers 1 through 7. And of that, numbers 1 through 6 constitute most of the plastics that are commonly used out in industrial settings right now.
And how much of that is recyclable?
Not very much. So in the U.S., we recover about 8.8%. to do various things at the end of its life with, which is quite low. So there's not very much that's recycled in the U.S.
We recover 8.8%. So that is the amount that actually gets recycled, or that's just the amount that we bring in to try to recycle?
That's the amount that we bring in to try to recycle. Mm. So PET is the number one, SPI number one, and that has a recovery rate of about 19.5% overall for that particular type of plastic. The next one is high-density polyethylene, which is about 10%. And then from there, it just drops off. So less than 5% of all other types of plastic are recovered.
And is the reason that we don't recycle more of it because of the method of recycling or because of the kind of plastic that we're using?
So it's both. So when we invented plastics, they were invented and produced to be durable. And so that, in and of itself, it is the biggest challenge for actually being able to recycle some of these virgin, plastic materials and get recycled materials that have the same properties. In addition to that, there's a lot of different varieties, and we have a method to recycling all of them, which doesn't necessarily work equally for each type of plastic. So it's actually both.
And when we do recycle the plastics that we can recycle, what we do with that is mix it in basically with a new plastic that is of the same type, right? That's the way that we make whatever it becomes.
Typically. So unless we are using it for what's called downcycling, so a good example is PET. If we take a plastic water bottle and want to turn it back into another plastic water mm-hmm. bottle, a lot of times what we'll do is take some of the recycled material and blend it in with virgin material in order to get something of good enough properties to act again as a water bottle. An alternative method to that is turning it into something like a carpet, for example, that doesn't require the same type of properties mm-hmm. as a plastic water bottle would.
So the type of recycling that we find most often in this country right now is called mechanical recycling, right?
Correct. Yeah. So that's typically what people think of when they think of recycling. So that entails taking a plastic, cutting it down into small pieces, decontaminating it, washing it of all organics, and then melting it down and remolding it mm-hmm. into the new product.
But you say we ought to be focused on chemical recycling. So what is that?
So chemical recycling is a different approach where instead of using a mechanical process where you're physically melting an object and then remolding it, what we're doing is we're actually tackling breaking bonds at the molecular level. So we design catalysts, for example, to go after very specific chemical functional groups in the backbone of a polymer, for example. And so what that enables us to do is actually target each different type selectively and use a different approach to break down each different type of plastic.
And what's the advantage of that?
The advantage is that you get selectivity. So you're able to go back in an ideal world. Chemical recycling would yield the monomer, which is the basic, most fundamental starting material of any plastic. And what that allows you to do is if you take that monomer and then repolymerize it, so you turn it back into a plastic again, you'll get a material at the end with identical properties as the virgin material. So in other words, you don't have this issue that we have right now with mechanical recycling where you get a diminishment in materials mm-hmm. and then you have to downcycle.
So why isn't chemical recycling more widely available?
Right now, chemical recycling is very isolated to different processes that require very high temperatures. So a lot of times what happens is if you've ever heard of thermal cracking of a polymer, that is what falls into the chemical recycling bucket right now of technologies. And what that usually requires is energy input of 500, 900 degrees Celsius. You usually have a catalyst in there. And then once you depolymerize it, you oftentimes will get a mixture of different products that you then have to separate. So in the end, the processes that are in place right now are oftentimes more expensive. And so they're not economically feasible compared to things like mechanical recycling. So the challenge there is going to be finding new catalysts that can, act at lower temperatures mm-hmm. and have better selectivity so that you, instead of getting a mixture of products, get maybe just one thing, preferably the monomer, to be able to reuse.
So that means that in addition to creating facilities where you could do chemical recycling, you also need to kind of change people's behaviors and get us using a certain kind of plastic that'll be easier to recycle chemically.
Yeah, so that is an alternative approach, is looking at new plastics and new types of materials that are designed to be broken down. And it's something I'm personally very excited about because we can, as synthetic chemists, we have capabilities of making materials with a variety of different properties. And if we think from the beginning to design them so that they can be chemically broken down at the end of their life, then we have a built-in end-of-life treatment for materials that could be used in a variety of different applications.
So how difficult will it be to get plastics made in a way that they'll be recyclable chemically?
I think it's going to be a little bit tough because a lot of the virgin materials that we use, the commodity plastics that we use right now, the 1-6 plastics, they've been being used for a long time. And a lot of them have been, they've been specialized for a very specific application. Industry really likes using it. They're cheap materials mm-hmm. As an alternative to other types of materials. And so I think the hurdle there is really going to be getting industries to wrap their head around using a different type of material that has equally as good properties and performance as the materials that they're used to using, and then getting the cost down over time. So there's a little bit of an energy of activation there to go into an area where you're going to start using new materials that they're not necessarily familiar with.
Now, you're a polymer chemist. How do you do your research on a daily basis on this topic and figure out where that plastic is going to come from?
So I really like the challenge of being able to find things that are in my lab or maybe in the building that are made out of plastics and then developing ways of breaking it down in the lab. So it's not outside of the realm of possibilities that you know, we'll go to the cafeteria and grab water bottles out of the recycling bins, take them back to our lab and test different catalysts on them to see what we get. Similarly, we also did this in the labs with an old CD that someone had used, which is technically considered to be e-waste. And we tried, you know, cutting that into pieces and then breaking that down with catalysts that we were developing.
Did it work?
Yeah. Yeah, it worked. So in that case, with the CD, using the waste as input, we were able to actually make a value-added polymer instead of downcycling. We did a value-add and ended up making an engineering thermoplastic that's used in medical applications for high-temperature medical equipment.
Hmm. Now, you're a polymer chemist at IBM. So how does this help a company like IBM?
Yeah, so what we typically do is, you know, in our research and development, and when we're working on very fundamental research like this, we'll patent our ideas and test them out. So right now we've done the fundamental research, we have the technologies kind of laid out, and we're doing it on small scale in our labs with, you know, my students' CDs or what have you.
Right.
So the next step is going to be to scaling these things up. We're obviously not a chemical company, so we need to partner with someone to do that. Get to a point where we can actually have tons of this material and then think about using it ourselves, perhaps.
That's Jamie Garcia, who is a polymer chemist at IBM. Jamie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
There's been more reaction to the press conference of Presidents Trump and Putin, who together criticized the U.S.-Russia investigation. House Speaker Paul Ryan rarely speaks out against Trump, but said in a statement, "There's no question Russia interfered in our election. The president should learn Russia is not an ally." Today, Putin was asked why President Trump should believe his denial.
Where did you get this idea that President Trump trusts me or I trust him? He defends the interests of the United States of America, and I do defend the interests of the Russian Federation.
Let's get the view from Russia with Pavel Sarikov, a political scientist with the Institute for USA and Canada Studies. Pavel, talk about the expectation there going into this meeting. We read many Russians thought Putin won just by going, and they thought he'd get them an end of isolation, an easing of sanctions, an acceptance of the seizing of Crimea. Is that your sense?
Well, I've just watched the public opinion polls, and I would say that slightly more than half of Russians are very cautiously optimistic about the summit. So they're not expecting a breakthrough, but they feel that the president would look each other in the eye and see that they are decent people and find something in common.
But do most Russians feel that Putin is right in his actions and that they deserve to have the sanctions lifted and they deserve to have the Crimea accepted?
Well, only 3 months ago, Putin won the presidential elections, and there were, I guess, 73% of Russians who voted for him. So, yes, Putin feels very big approval of his actions in among Russians. And most Russians actually approve the Crimea situation. So, yes, yeah. And Donald Trump even made a slight hint that, well, he was asked whether he's going to acknowledge Crimea, and he said, "We'll see," which a lot of Russians perceived as a hint that he's going to acknowledge Crimea as a part of Russia.
What is the view on the world view of Russia? On Friday, Special Counsel, U.S. Special Counsel Robert Mueller indicted 12 more Russian intelligence officers claiming hacking in the 2016 election. There was documentation that showed that it was these Russians, not a Romanian, behind Guccifer 2.0 who had the hacked material. And the documentation also showed that during the campaign, on the very day that Donald Trump said, "Russia, if you're listening, get those Hillary Clinton emails," and that is the very day that the Russians, Robert Mueller alleges, hacked those emails. We understand that you're also skeptical of Russia's hacking of the U.S. election. Really? With all of that information?
I'm skeptical because I've been trying to find the smoking gun evidences, and I see that it's always harder to prove that you didn't do something mm-hmm. than to prove that you did something.
There's also accusations that Russia interfered in the Brexit vote, that Russia was behind the poisoning yeah. of people Russia, in Britain.
The Brexit vote, the Catalonia vote, the French presidential elections. So Russia have been accused of many, many different things. But every time when the United States accused Russia of meddling with the presidential elections, that is interference into national sovereignty. But when Robert Mueller indicted 12 Russian citizens of meddling with American elections, he gave Donald Trump additional information to talk about with Putin. But obviously, Russia is not going to extradite these 12 Russians. Mm-hmm. And even if Putin would do that, the sanctions would not be lifted mm-hmm. and the relations would not come back to what they used to be before 2014 either.
What was Russians' sense of Vladimir Putin as he headed into the summit? We're reading that they believe that he is a grand chess master, that with his KGB background and his years of experience, you know, he will outmaneuver President Trump. Is that the sense?
I think so, yes. Can I say something about the Russian general perception of the information that Russia meddled with U.S. elections?
Please.
Because I think this is interesting, because despite the fact that Russian official position is denial that Russia ever interfered in U.S. presidential elections, very significant part of Russian society actually believes that Russia did meddle, and they are proud of it.
And they feel that's to Putin's credit, which goes to what we were talking about.
That goes to Putin's credit on one hand. And that actually what makes Donald Trump look worse, because if Donald Trump was perceived as Putin's friend, then every time Donald Trump says something bad about Russia or about Russian leadership, that, you know, makes his ratings in Russia go down. And people really think of Putin as a good negotiator. They think that Putin would somehow reach certain agreements with Donald Trump.
But just the overall idea, it seems like you're saying Russians think that Putin is smart and Trump maybe not so much, and that Putin will outmaneuver him.
I think, yes, that is certain that there are sentiments like this.
Yeah. Pavel Sherikov is a political scientist with the Institute for USA and Canada Studies. We reached him in Moscow. Pavel, thank you so much.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
So Russian people believed the hacking did happen, and they are proud of it. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.